the morning. For those of you who've been here since 8:45, we're probably starting to feel like the afternoon. There's still plenty of time to go Passover shopping after these sessions are done. I wanted to introduce myself. I'm Dina Weiss. I'm the Rosh Beit Midrash at Yeshivat Hadar, and really happy to be here today. Really excited to be learning with all of you. Before I pass out the source sheets and before we start diving into a somewhat difficult text, I wanted to ask you perhaps an even more difficult question. And that is, what are the things that you expect that a person of faith might encounter in their life that would cause them to have a crisis of faith, that might cause them to lose their faith in God, feel more distant from God? And I'm going to, because there are thankfully so many people in this room, I'm going to limit the responses here to four, because that's the number of the day. So if just four people want to weigh in on what do you think it might be that might cause someone who is initially in a position of faith to feel distant and to lose that faith? Yeah.
It's a classic when bad things happen to good people problem, you know, when someone who's been good and done all the right things in life and religiously, whatever, either struck with a serious illness or a child passes away or a business disaster, you wonder, you know, they were doing all the right things and bad stuff still happened.
Right, like I was following the playbook, I did exactly what I was supposed to do, and it seems like nothing I do is good enough, because still these terrible things are happening to me in my life. Great, yeah.
Modern science.
Science. Say a little bit more.
Well, you can explain a lot just by the equations of mathematics and physics. You don't have to invoke God.
Right, so a lot of the questions that people had previously gone to God to answer or gone to Jewish tradition to answer, they might be able to find those answers in science, and then they might feel like God's role in their life is getting smaller and smaller and smaller to the point in which it kind of disappears. Great, it's a great challenge. Yeah.
Maybe disappointment, petitioning to God through prayer and not getting, right? Dissatisfaction with.
Great, and this is kind of like the compliment. One is, I've done everything right, I can't believe all these terrible things are happening. And the other is that I asked you explicitly not to do this, and you're clearly not listening to me. So I'm trying to have a relationship with you, and the way that I would know that you're sort of listening is if what I asked for comes to pass, and it's just not happening. So what am I getting out of this relationship? I might as well skedaddle. Yeah, last one.
Seeing people who have absolutely no connection to God, still having a fantastic, wonderful, fun life.
Great. Right. The people that are working on Saturday don't seem to be making less money than me who's stuck at home on Saturday. So maybe keeping Shabbat is not the, you know, financial and spiritual boon that I once thought it was, because all of the people that don't have access to Judaism or had access and don't care, or, you know, even just God more broadly, they don't seem to be losing out. They actually seem to be having a lot more fun than me sitting at home for 8 days eating crackers, right? The people that are out eating this very I always walk around on Passover just thinking that everybody else gets to eat things that are squishy, and I have to eat things that are flat. And I just sort of like walk around. It's not even the bread that I miss. It's actually the sensation of like being able to go like this with my food. And I just get so jealous of the squishiness that before Passover was not even something that I was interested in, right? But to sort of see that other people who are not bound in this way get to have all of these benefits makes me wonder if there's any reason why I would be bound.
Marshmallows.
That is a very good, thank you so much. You just saved my Passover. I'm not sure if you saved my blood sugar or you saved my Passover. So I'm not going to answer any of these questions, obviously, but we are going to look at a text that I think is going to shift our focus a little bit from some of the classical things that we might think might drive someone away from God, and look at it from a totally different vantage point. And I think that looking at this problem through this different lens might end up helping us have a language or a framework to talk about some of the things that we are otherwise sort of struggling with in terms of that relationship. So what I'm going to do now is pass out the sheets. I hope that we have enough, but people can share. Yes.
This is going to be getting to Passover, correct? Or is this the one?
We are going to be talking about Passover.
Okay.
But this is not a practical, what are you going to do at your Seder kind of question. It's going to be more about reflecting on some of the aspects of the Seder. But you're not in the wrong session. So now that everybody has the source sheets, you can all exhale a sigh of relief, or the first source on the page is from the Passover Haggadah. Don't worry, we're going to talk about the Haggadah. And this text, right, is actually, what the Mishnah in Psachim talks about how you're supposed to structure the Seder. There's the four questions, the Manishtana. Then there's some sort of conversation about going from a negative experience to a positive experience, somehow a retelling of the Passover story that hit those points, and then you're supposed to go through this passage of Arami Oved Avi, my father was a wandering Aramean, or an Aramean sought to destroy my father. So we're actually going to be focusing on this passage. First, we're going to look at it and in its original context. Then we're going to read a somewhat lengthy Hasidic explanation of this passage in its original context in the reading of the Bikurim. And then we're going to go back and together sort of talk about how we can use what we've learned about this text in its original context to help us think about how it might shed light on our experience on Passover and how we sort of treat the Passover Seder. So if you look at the very beginning, you'll see, Tzeyu Lamad, go and learn what Lavan the Aramean wanted to do to our father Yaakov. For Pharaoh only decreed against the males, but Lavan wanted to uproot all. As it says, an Aramean was destroying my father. And he went down to Egypt and dwelt there few in number. And there he became a nation, great, mighty, and populous. Etc. I'd like a volunteer to read the Psukim in Dvarim, which are the original context for these verses, for this story of my father was a wandering Aramean. Yeah, thank you.
Mm-hmm. ולקחת מראשית כל פרי אדמה אשר תביא מארצך אשר אדוני אליך נותן לך ושמת בתנת ולכת אל המקום אשר יבחר אדוני אליך לשכן שמו שם.
I'm going to just pause you there. Somebody want to read these three verses in the English?
Yes.
Thank you.
And it shall be when you come into the land which the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance, and you possess it and dwell in it, that you shall take some of the first of all the produce of the ground which you shall bring from your land that the Lord your God is giving you, and put it in a basket, and go to the place where the Lord your God chooses to make his name abide.
Thank you.
And you shall go to the one who is priest in those days, and say to him, I declare today to the Lord your God that I have come to the country which the Lord swore to our honors, to our fathers, to give us.
Okay, I'm going to pause you there. We're going to take up again in the Hebrew. Take it from three. Take it from three to the end, and then we'll do the English, so everybody will hear it twice.
ארמי עובד אבי וירד מצרים ויגר שם במתי מעט, ויהי שם הגוי גדול עצום ורב. ויראו אותנו המצרים ויענונו בידינו, ויתנו עלינו עבודה קשה. ונצעק על אדוני אלוהי אבותינו וישמע אדוני את קולנו ויגד אבינו ואת עמורנו ואת לחצינו. ואוציא אדוני ממצרים מיד חזקה זו הנביאה ומור הגדול ואותו כמותי. ויבינו על המקום הזה וייתן לנו את הארץ הזאת אשר זבת חלב ודבש. ואתה, הנה, הבאתי את ראשית פרי האדמה אשר נתנת לי אדוני והנחתו לפני אדוני אליך והשתחווית לפני אדוני אליך. ושמחת בכל הטוב אשר נתן לך אדוני אליך ולביתך אתה והלוי והגר אשר
beautiful, right? And I hope that hearing it in the Hebrew was allowed you to hear some of the echoes of when we've actually gone through these verses in the Seder. Let's just take it in English.
And you should go to the one who was priest in those days and say to him, I declare today to the Lord your God, I have come to the country which the Lord swore to our fathers to give us. Then the priest shall take the basket out of your hand and set it down before the altar of the Lord your God. And you shall answer and say before the Lord your God, my father was a Syrian about to perish, or my father was a wandering Aramean, and he went down to Egypt and dwelt there few in number. And there he became a nation, great, mighty, and populous. But the Egyptians mistreated us, afflicted us, and laid hard bondage on us. Then we cried out to the Lord God of our fathers, and the Lord heard our voice, and looked on our affliction and our labor and our oppression. So the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand and with an outstretched arm and with great terror and with signs and wonders. He has brought us to this place and has given us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey. And now, behold, I have brought the first fruits of the land which you, O Lord, have given me. Then shall you set it before the Lord your God and worship before the Lord your God. So you shall rejoice in every good thing which the Lord your God has given you, given to you and your house, you and the Levite and the stranger who is among you.
Beautiful. Thank you. So let me ask you, right here we have this scene, right, of the first fruits. I come to the priest at that time, I put all my first fruits in this beautiful basket, and I come and I present it to the priest who's in Jerusalem, and I say this long declaration. What's the reason for my saying this long declaration? Why am I telling this story that begins with Arami Oved Avi? Just in the plain sense of the verses. It's
cultural context.
Say a little more.
It's giving cultural context to why you're bringing the offerings to the priest.
Okay, great. Anything else that you think is going on here? Why would I feel the need to say this passage now? Yeah.
Because it's so powerful to say here, I'm coming here, I'm bringing you something that I was wandering. It's like drawing the contrast of how far I've come.
Right, in some sense, it makes the fruit a little sweeter, a little bit more precious. Right, I came from nothing, and look at this beautiful fruit that I'm able to bring because I'm in this holy land, and this holy land has produced this fruit for me. Great, anything else? Yeah.
It feels to me related to your opening question of us about the things that may cause people to lose faith, and it feels like recounting this series of reasons for having faith stands in contrast, or maybe a reminder that is needed from time to time about we've lost faith for these reasons, but these are reasons to have faith.
So you can sort of imagine someone a few years later might be called in their memory to remember the time when they were so happy with their first fruits and that they were able to see how far they came, and this might give them energy, right, not just for this small moment, but for their harvest in the future. Great, that's very beautiful. Yeah.
I also think of something like this, particularly when you're giving up your first fruits, and if anyone's ever had a garden, you know that's not an easy thing to do, that you are reminded of everything that came before and why you're doing it. So often when we perform a ritual, we say to ourselves, why am I doing this? And this is a great way of them never forgetting.
Great. And then why would this be the passage that I would want to delve into at my Passover Seder? Right, we could have read the Passover story from the Parshiot in Shmot when the Torah actually tells us the story of the Exodus. But instead what we have is a passage of the Torah of us telling the story at this particular period of time. Why choose this passage as opposed to the passages earlier of the actual Exodus? Yeah, David.
The verse's passive voice.
Meaning, because here I'm able to say, this has happened to me, right? And this is a manifestation of the first time someone actually is stating in the way that we would like to state at our Seder.
I'm not telling it as history. I'm telling it as something. I mean, it ties in with the other places in the Seder where you talk about the Kol Bador and the other things that you say. This is an active statement.
Right, right. This is personal narrative as opposed to some sort of historical reading that I am just bringing out. Yeah.
Combines the two aspects that we were talking about in the last hour, which is freedom. I mean, this is the act of a free man to have something to give of his own free will, and worship. This is a godly act that he's doing. is not really just paying taxes the way we do. It has a religious and worshipful aspect to it.
Great, and I'm glad that you brought up taxes, because there are other agricultural mitzvot, which basically function as taxes. You have to give 10% of this, 1% of that. And at those junctures, there is no statement like this. This kind of declaration is reserved for this, I think, and as you pointed out, difficult and particularly meaningful moment in your sort of agricultural life. So what we're going to do now is we're going to turn to page 2, and we are going to start to read this passage from the Mor Vashemesh. Mor Vashemesh is one of the earliest Hasidic teachers, right? He lived before the time of Hasidic dynasties. So he is considered to be one of the foundational texts because everybody can claim him, right? If you're this kind of Hasid, you still are going to go back to that earlier type of Hasidism during the time of the Mor Vashemesh. And I just, before we go inside, wanted to ask you what you know about Hasidic literature in general, what you think characterizes it. Just so before we go in to read this specific genre of text, what do you think we might expect to hear him say or do? Okay, great. So I'm going to give you a little taste of where we're going. Seems like we're all basically in the same boat with this. So what I would say the most significant hallmark of Hasidic readings of the Torah is that they'll take something and read it as a metaphor. So to give you an example, one of the most famous Hasidic teachings are on Pesach is the idea that chametz is actually a representative of your own internal yetzer hara, your own internal evil inclination, your own laziness, right? It's represented by chametz's ability to rise and be left aside to continue to get puffier and squishier, right? As it continues to grow. And so it becomes something that's symbolic of our own arrogance, our own evil inclination. So what the Hasidic teachings do, and one of the reasons why in their time and in our time they're still a little bit controversial, right, is to say that aside for what is being taught to us on the sort of plain sense meaning, there's also some sort of spiritual symbolic meaning that's being attached to it that you would not necessarily have access to if you were just reading the Torah on its most basic level. So how we are going to go through this text is we're going to go through his questions. And you'll see that he asks questions on the passage that we just read together, which none of us would have thought to ask, because this passage is actually rather straightforward. We understand that as you bring your first fruits, you're going to recite this declaration, and it makes sense, and it's very beautiful. I think we all found it, at least I did. I found it very moving to hear it be read out loud. It seems like a very meaningful kind of ritual. And the Mor Vashemesh is going to ask these four questions that try to destabilize you from your normal understanding of this passage. It's not because he doesn't understand the reason of the passage the way that we do, but he's trying to ask these questions so that you're open to seeing a different interpretation, because you're going to see that there might be something that doesn't hang together perfectly, and that little opening is going to be sufficient for you to be receptive to a second or additional approach to these verses. So what we're going to do is I'm going to read through what he says, and when we get to certain junctures and when we get to the end, I'm going to leave it to you to sort of supply some of the meaning and the personal context. So I'm going to read through and teach this text, but I want you, as we're going through it, to think about what aspect of what he's saying is meaningful to you and relevant to you, and what seems kind of foreign, strange, or almost historical. Right? I could imagine the people back in his time, in the 18th century, would think like this, but I wouldn't. And if there's a moment where you're like, oh, I really understand how this is relevant to me, even if other parts of the passage might not have seemed that way to you. And of course, right, to keep in mind that question that we had at the beginning of the session of why is it that somebody would lose their faith? Because he's going to address that question. Okay, we're going inside. I'm going to pause at each box for clarification questions. And if you don't have any clarification questions, we're just going to keep on plowing ahead, because the time is short and the work is great. Okay. Va'anita va'amarta lefnei Adonai Elohecha, and you are going to respond and say, before the Lord your God, Arami Oved Avi, the Syrian pursued my father, Vayered Mitzrayimah, and he went down to Egypt, and sojourned there in a very small number, and grew into a nation great and strong and of an infinite multitude. Ma'nishtana mitzvat bikurim mikol sharei mitzvot ha-Torah. right, this language should sound familiar to you, right? What is different? What makes the mitzvah bikurim of these first fruit different from the rest of the mitzvot of the Torah? Now, I would be lying if I said that he never uses the phrase manishtana anywhere else in his writings, but I could find only one place where when he used it, it wasn't connected to Pesach. So I think there is something intentional here in his using that language from the Mishnah of how is this mitzvah different from all the other mitzvot. All the other mitzvot, we don't have to do this, but for this mitzvah, we do. That's how you should hear it in your mind. So what makes the mitzvah of Bikurim different from the rest of the mitzvot of the Torah? In that one is required to mention what Lavan did to our father Yaakov. This is his first question. Why is this the mitzvah that we have to bring Yaakov and Lavan in? There are all sorts of mitzvot that are applicable to the land of Israel. There are all sorts of mitzvot which might benefit from some kind of narrative to give it some context, to give it some meaning. Why is this the one? Even more so, this is not really a reason for why we bring the Bikurim. Even if I want to say that I always want to give some sort of context, some sort of explanation for why I'm doing a mitzvah, this is not actually a real explanation for this particular mitzvah. That our father was saved from Laban. What is the connection between these two things? What is the connection between the fact that my forefather, Jacob, worked for this bad father-in-law for a long time and left, and the fact that I'm bringing these first fruits when I live in the land of Israel? How is that connected? That's question number two. And also, question number three. The telling of the exodus of Egypt requires understanding. What relevance does bringing Bikurim have to do with this more than to other mitzvot? Meaning, we give because you were strangers in the land of Egypt as a rationale for so many of our mitzvot. Why is it specifically with these first fruits that this is the time that I'm going to bring the exodus from Egypt? I could not do any of God's commandments if I were still a slave. I would not be able to dress the way I wanted to. I would not be able to bring any of the offerings. I would not be able to celebrate any of the holidays. So why is this the time that I'm going to get all worked up and talk about the Exodus? And the last question, which is kind of a general question, also, what is the reason for this mitzvah? Just plain, why are we doing this? Even though all of the mitzvot are the king's commands to his servants, right, so here he's kind of backing away, right, even though I don't need a reason, because all of the mitzvot are the king's commands, are God commands, still, each mitzvah has a reason. So I'm I'm a little bit hesitant to ask what's the reason for this mitzvah, because I know that I have to do it even if there's no reason. But even though I have to do it without a reason, it still has a reason, and I want to know what that reason is. Right, so here are four questions. Here are our new four questions. The first question is, why is this the mitzvah about which we have to mention Lavan and Yaakov? The second question is, there doesn't seem to be any specific connection between these two. And therefore, the second question is, why bring up the Exodus from Egypt in connection here? You could imagine talking about Lavan and Yaakov without talking about the Exodus, and you could imagine talking about the Exodus without talking about Lavan and Yaakov. So then there are two separate questions. Why bring up both of these or either of these? The third question is, why, if I'm going to tell the Exodus, is specifically with this mitzvah and not any of the other mitzvot? And the fourth question is, what's going on with this mitzvah in general? What is the point of my bringing the Bikurim, of bringing these first fruits? Any pshat, simple understanding of the text questions?
Can I just ask a question? Oh, I'm sorry.
Is it a comprehension question?
I think so. I always learned that Jacob went down to Egypt because of famine, not because he couldn't get along with his father-in-law.
Great. So that there's a little bit of a midrashic background here that he's going to loop into his conversation. He has an understanding, which we'll see later, that this was a punishment. That the fact that Jacob had to go down to Egypt, which the immediate cause was the famine, but the reason that that famine would affect him in that way has to do with his interactions with Laban, his father-in-law. It's a great question.
This isn't so much biography, but Rev Epstein and these questions. Are these real inconsistencies that he and the other Hasidic rabbis are seeing in the text? Are these questions raised because this is simply how these rabbis engaged
with the text?
I think it's somewhere in the middle. I don't think that he disagrees with our basic understanding of what's going on in these verses and why this narrative is here. But he's trying to tease out all of the components and say, is this really necessary here? Could I have had one without the other? Wouldn't this narrative have made as much sense in the context of another mitzvah? So he's asking us these questions so that we're open to accepting a broader explanation, even though I don't think that he actually thinks that if I didn't have the answers to these questions, I wouldn't understand what's going on. So it's somewhere in the middle. Good question. Okay, we are moving on. And it appears with this that the Holy Torah has come to open the eyes of humanity, insofar as all of the time that a person is on this earth, different stresses will surround him, which are different from one another, and there is no person who does not have both a time of pressure and a time of ease. Indeed, if the insightful person looks with an open eye at all of the events and temporary happenings that occur to him, he will see with his eye and understand with his heart that all that emanated from God is for the good, to benefit him in the end. Right? So he says everybody has experiences, ups and downs in their lives. But if somebody really has insight, they will, and faith, right, they will understand that everything that happens from God is for the good. And so even if now I'm experiencing a time of pressure and a time of need, I am going to understand that it's all going to turn out all right, or that the reason for it is some sort of good reason. Therefore, it is appropriate to accept them with a pleasant attitude and not to be disgusted by them. Right? Since I know that everything comes from God and everything is ultimately for the good, when bad things happen to me, I just swallow it. Right? And I have a pleasant attitude and I'm looking to the future and I take it all in stride. Indeed, he should run to know and come to the truth of the good in these events. And God will grant him insight and will show him that good. And he has to, you know, put some effort right into seeing how these bad events might turn out to be good, but he should do that and God will show that to him. And his reward is great if he does this, for he relied on God and it is considered righteousness, and one who does not do so has not done well. Right? And he says, and you really have to work hard at adopting this position. You have to have this perspective, and if you're not working hard to take what's bad in your life and see it as good, you have not done well. Or this is a very, I would say, heavy-handed approach towards people experiencing times of crisis. You think it's bad, it's good. You don't believe that it's good, think a little harder. Right? You really believe in God, you really believe that everything comes from God, and that God is good, do the math. Everything that comes in your life is ultimately for the good. This is his position here. And what's our precedent for this? Behold, our father Yaakov suffered many troubles. He was forced to run away to Aram because of Esau. And even there, Laban afflicted him in many ways. Right? His brother wanted to kill him. And he runs away to another relative. And that relative, instead of welcoming him with open arms, right, exploits him, exploits his labor. So Yaakov had a lot of reasons to be pretty upset, to be unfaithful. But in truth, in all that occurred to our father Yaakov, God's intention was for the good. And they were good in the end. And similarly, all of the events that God causes to happen to a person, they are good from God. For his entire intent is for good, for his entire aim is to benefit his creatures. Right, so you're kind of experiencing Yaakov, you're seeing his life, and you're seeing it as a model for what your life could be. Yaakov's life was pretty bad, but it got pretty good. So too, I'm going to study Yaakov's example, and when my life is pretty bad, it's going to turn out to be pretty good. Right? That's his first stab, and I would say that's a very tried and true and frustrating approach towards the bad things that happen in our lives. Right? And I think in the beginning we were talking about what would cause a crisis of faith, and we were talking mostly about things that disturb our narrative of God's goodness. Here he's saying when you approach those elements of your life that disturb your narrative of God's goodness, study a little harder. I would say this is classical, and I would agree a little bit frustrating. I think that when we were articulating how bad things can make you lose your faith, that seemed to me to be a lot more true to experience than here's how you get out of that problem, talk yourself out of that problem. So I'm just going to take any questions or comments about this section. Yeah, Dana.
I can't imagine anything that I find more unacceptable than this approach.
Great. Noted. Yes.
I feel the opposite. I feel like that's what helps things along. Things are really hard. It's just that we don't know why things happen, but that we need to find positive and go on. I don't think you can say it's heavy-handed. I feel like it's my lifeboat, you know? It's a lifeboat.
That's different. That's not the point I'm making. The question is whether the bad things come from God. The question is not whether you can do the best that you can to live with your life make the best out of it. The question is a philosophical one, a theological one, as to whether you view all of these things as things that God has brought upon you. I find this to be a very fundamentalist approach that's just unacceptable to the way in which I approach God.
Great, I'm going to take one more comment on this. Yeah.
When he says things are bad, it's just a matter of how you perception. So what you might consider bad, somebody might consider good.
I suspect
good.
Something you call
consider bad. No, because... Because you have to look at the bigger picture sometimes. And sometimes good things come from bad.
Okay, great. I think we have some people in the room that feel like this approach gives them some comfort and actually resonates with how they approach the bad things in their life. And some people that feel like theologically there's something very troubling here, and maybe he's asking for more than he's really permitted to ask for. You seem very...
I think it relates back to what my mother used to tell me, mm-hmm. that if we put all our things in the middle, we're sitting around, put all our things in the middle of the floor, all our problems, we're going to take ours back. We're going to find out that all the others are worse than ours.
Beautiful. Okay, great. Sage wisdom. So I actually, this is not the component of his argument that I'm interested in focusing on. Psych. Turn to page 3, and you'll see that he moves in an entirely different direction. Because before he was speaking about the problems that we all raised at the beginning, the problems to faith that are raised by bad things. Now he's going to turn and talk about good things. What are the problems to faith that might be brought up by good things? And so, sometimes God will test a person who serves God with the good things that he bestows on him. And this person, because his desire is in the service of God and that good, it will appear to him that this good is distracting him from the service of God, and it will not seem right to him to accept it. And also in this, he must be sure not to be ungrateful, so that he not reject, God forbid, the good that the omnipresent bestows on him. Indeed, it is right for him to know that everything is being given to him for his benefit, even if it seems to him that he is being distracted by this from the service of God. But if he really seeks to be aware of the goodness of God, he will strive for this, and he will open his eyes and understand his true goodness. Right, so here, the Morva Shemesh is imagining someone who is experiencing a crisis of faith, not because he is experiencing a lot of trauma or a lot of bad news, but because he's gotten to a point in his life where he's afraid of the good, where he finds that the good is distracting him from his holy service. I think we need to unpack why this is or how this is. But before we do, I want us to get to the end, where he sort of ties everything together, and then we'll have a little bit more background and a little bit more framework to talk about what he's raised in this paragraph. Right? But he's advocating the same approach to the good that he advocated for the bad. Just as when you received the bad, you said, this comes from God. Ultimately, this is for the good. He wants you to take that approach when you are troubled by the good. When you're trying to avoid the good, he says you need to bring that in. You need to understand that you can also serve God with the good. Okay. Behold, also the evil Lavan had this as his aim in all of his involvement with our father Yaakov, to change his spirit and to distract him with his business, so that he would, God forbid, express a verbal opposition to the One on High, to reject the goodness of the Omnipresent, and to think that he gave him something that distracted him from his service. Right, so here it's a little bit complicated, but I think that what the Maor V'Shemesh is imagining in this midrashic world, the place where Yaakov was before he went to Laban's house was a Beit Midrash. He was in yeshiva for 14 years. And he was living a pretty ascetic existence where he didn't have a lot of flocks. He didn't have more money, more problems. He just had Torah all day and all night. And then he moves to Lavan's house. And the kind of oppression that Lavan is exerting on him is a kind of killing with kindness, right? He's giving him flocks that he now has to worry about. And at night he's dreaming about what color his flocks are. And he has to worry about his business. And he's so concerned that he's being stolen from. These concerns are all concerns that are born from having. When you don't have anything, you're not dreaming at night about, you know, whether somebody forgot to carry the one and you're going to lose $500,000. You don't have those concerns. And what Lavan is doing with Yaakov by giving him charge of his flocks is he's putting him in this position where goodness, where wealth is causing him problems. Where he got one wife, but now he wants the other wife. Okay. And Yaakov was slightly trapped by this intention of Lavan. And it worked. Right, Yaakov actually had this experience of all of my wealth and all of the material acquisition that I am experiencing is distracting me from God. And he said, Nistara darki me'adonai, my path is hidden from God. So this is part of another Midrashic tradition where each of the forefathers got up and they say, here's why I had trouble serving God. And for Yaakov, it was this. It was, I was too wealthy, and this is why my path was hidden from God. It is not a quote from the five books of Moses. It's a quote from Yeshayahu. And the blessed name, right, i.e. God, was concerned, lest at the time that he brings his people to a land of fields and vineyards, which are things that, through dealing with them, distract a person from serving his creator, they will reject his kindness, that should be a capital H, because they will imagine that it is something unsuitable to their service of he whose name shall be blessed. Right, God is nervous that people are going to become wealthy in the land of Israel and they're not going to want that wealth. They're not going to want the vineyards and they're going to think it's a distraction for my spiritual life to have this material goodness. Therefore, God commanded them to bring Bikurim, to bring these first fruits, and to recite upon them what happened to Yaakov Avinu. Right, what they're learning from Yaakov is don't spurn the good. When you bring the good, be grateful for it as good. And this is Arami Oved Avi, that he wanted to distract him. Lavan wanted to distract Yaakov so that Yaakov would reject, God forbid, the goodness of the blessed Creator. And because of this, he, Yaakov, was punished. And it came to pass that he went down to Egypt. And what the Mor Vashemesh is doing beautifully here is he's saying that the Arami Oved Avi of the Midrashic sense and the Arami Oved Avi of the Pshat sense, the Arami Oved Avi that thinks that Lavan is the Aramean that sought to destroy my father, and the Arami Oved Avi, my father was a wandering Aramean, those two are actually the same, they're pointing to the same problem, the same issue. The reason why Yaakov ended up being a wandering Aramean is because he bought in to what Lavan was trying to do to him, to try to kill him with this kindness. So therefore, we say Arami Oved Avi, and he wanted to distract him so that he rejected the goodness of the blessed Creator. And because of this, he, Yaakov, was punished, and it came to pass that he went down to Egypt. And this is why we recite, he went down to Egypt, so that we will be careful not to reject the good that he has bestowed on us, and will recognize that they are for the true good, and not in order to confuse us from his service, and to thank him and to praise him for all of this good. And this is what Rashi said, Rashi commenting on the passage of Bikurim. In the initial interaction with the priest, with the Kohen, it says, V'amarta elav, you should say to the Kohen. And what is that? Rashi says, that is where you should tell him that you are not ungrateful. Right? And the Mor Vashemesh is pointing out here, this is the point in time when you would be most grateful. Why is this person at risk of not being grateful? Because this person might not be grateful for good. But he might be worried about what good, what wealth might do to him. And you shall recognize him in all of your ways, even when you are showered with all manner of good, right? Even when you are experiencing goodness, so it seems to me. right? And I was surprised that when I asked the question about Hasidut, no one mentioned anything about serving God with joy, right, and serving God through the material world. But it seems here that what he's saying is you might think that you have this sort of spiritual dimension where everything is disconnected from this world, and anything connected to this world, especially good things, right, might distract you from the service of God. And the more you're in the mindset of the way to get through a crisis of faith is to say everything is going to happen for the good, the more you sort of become trapped to having a faith life that's about the future. God is going to make things better, or God has made things good in the past, and isn't actually about where you are right now. So if you look on page one, the very last verse of this passage, it says, "V'samachta b'chol hatov asher natan lecha Adonai Elohecha ulebeitecha." Right, and you should rejoice in every good thing which the Lord your God has given to you and to your house. You and the Levite and the stranger who is among you. Right, but another way to read bekirbecha is inside you. Right, the part of you that feels estranged from this goodness. You recite the passage of Arami Oved Avi so that you actually experience this as joyful. You eradicate the anxiety that you might have over being blessed by reciting this passage. What's significant about this passage, according to the Mor Vashemesh, is not the Exodus narrative. What's important about this passage is the connection that we have to Yaakov. That Yaakov made a mistake in his evaluation of his material benefits, and we have to learn from Yaakov's mistake, lest we too end up being sent down to Egypt. Lest we end up having to repeat this same cycle of only crying out to God because we are oppressed. Right? The Mor Vashemesh wants you to live in a world where you don't only cry out to God when you're oppressed, you cry out to God all the time. Because when things are good, you say things are good. And when things are bad, you say things are going to get good. Right? He wants you to be living in this mindset of liveness, right? Of really experiencing God's goodness as being very present and being very safe. And the reason why I wanted to talk about this passage in the context of the Seder is that there is a progression in the Mishnah. I'll read it to you since I found it in this room. First it says, "Bechan haben shoel ha'aviv," right? And here, this is the point at the second cup where the son will ask the father, "Vim ein dat babein aviv mulamdo," and if the child is not able to, then the father teaches him. Manishtana halayla hazeh, how is this night different from all other nights? Then the manishtana is in the Mishnah. And then the next stage is, matchil bignut umisayim b'shabach. Right, you start with the negative story and you end up with the positive story. Those of you who are in Ellie conference class know exactly how this plays out. And then after you do that, vidoresh me'arami oved avi, then you go and you expound on this passage from the Bikurim of my father was a wandering Aramean. Ad sheyigmor kol ha'parasha kula, until you finish the entire passage of the Arami Oved Avi passage, which I think in the pshat of the Mishnah, although not in the history of Bavel, means including bringing us to the land of Israel, right, where you see that everything goes to the good. And if we really understand what the Mor Vashemesh is trying to teach us here in the context of the Haggadah, the Mishnah says there are these four questions that you ask about what's going on in the Seder. And then there's a way that you tell the Exodus story, which is with this narrative arc from bad to good. Now it's good and it's getting better, it's getting better, we're going to be in Israel. And then there's teaching the whole story of Arami Oved Avi. And the Mor Vashemesh is saying, that's a separate mode from starting from bad and going to good. That is a mode that deals with goodness, not as some sort of contrast to badness. Doesn't have its animating force from the contrast. It's good for goodness's sake, right? It just is what it is. And I think that we spend a lot of energy at the Seder on the Manishtana type questions and on the story of moving from Exodus to redemption, but maybe not as much time dwelling on how we feel right now. Thinking less about every generation needs to think as if they've left Egypt. But what does it mean to me to be a free person? right? How do I feel free? What are the advantages to being free? What are the disadvantages to being free? Where am I in this moment right now, as opposed to where am I situated in the arc of history? And something that I find very moving about the Passover Seder is that the Manish Tana questions are the same questions every year, because every year we fix something about the Seder that is going to be, that's going to pique the curiosity of the children. And the children ask the same questions every year, not only because it's in the Mishnah, but because the ritual of the Passover Seder is the same every year. Every year we're not eating bread. Every year we're dipping. And those are the things that are like interesting and curious to a kid, and they might ask about. But the questions that adults ask every year are not the same questions every year. Our lives move and our lives change, and we don't care about the same thing that we did in 2002 as we do in 2014. And to be repeating the same text and not giving ourselves the opportunity to ask questions that relate to where we are now, I think that we're losing that third element of the Seder, of just going and studying the passage of our Mi Oveid Avi, which covers all of history, from prehistory with my father Yaakov, to going down to Egypt, coming up through Egypt, and now being in the Promised Land, where I am now, and here's what I've brought. Right here are my first fruits, and here is what I would like to talk to the priest and talk to God about now. So we have about 5 minutes left, and I just wanted to open up the conversation to ask you if you think that this is a relevant framework for your Seder going forward, and particularly on the question that was raised in the first paragraph on page 3, what ways you feel that goodness could be interpreted as something that might distract you from your service of God, and what you might want to do to combat that feeling. Yeah.
One of the things that some people talk about in the Seder being, Pesach being, a deprivation holiday, that you don't get to eat bread, whatever, but it always struck me as the Seder was also a very, in my family, sumptuous meal, It's not a very deprivation kind of situation. So this sort of balances that, the deprivation and the good, that you're sort of celebrating the good and not just the avdut.
Great, right, and that's in the fabric of the Passover meal itself, that you say, I'm eating lechem oni, I'm eating poor man's bread. At the same time, you're drinking 4 cups of wine, right? That's, both of those poles, I think, are expressed very nicely in the Seder. Yeah, beautiful. Any other thoughts about this?
Right.
So the proof text here, you would have to have seen the larger midrash, which she assumes that you know, which I do not, is that there's a midrash where Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov each lodge their complaint against God. Why did you do this to me? Why did you make my life hard in this way? And Yaakov says, Nistara darki mehashem, my way was hidden from God, which is a kind of spiritual complaint. Why did you make my life so hard spiritually? And that's taken to mean, why was I so distracted by this world when I really wanted to be on a higher spiritual plane? And the Morva Shemesh links that specifically to his wealth, right? Why is he so distracted? Because he's a wealthy person with a lot of children and a lot of goodness that he needs to deal with.
What I find distracting about all this is that still in the beginning of the story, when God is giving Abraham the land, God says, you're going to be slaves for 400 years. So it's all preordained anyway, and this seems like this is just some sort of contrivance to get Yaakov down there. So what would they say about that?
That's a great question. I think that even though God promises Abraham that his children are going to go down to Egypt, it doesn't necessarily say which children at what point. So I think that in part it's Yaakov is the one that has to go through this because Yaakov is the one that needs to learn this lesson. And it's not necessarily that it would not have happened otherwise, but that why is it happening to me now? Because I need to learn this lesson, right? And I think that part of what's happening with all of this is exactly your question, meaning if I believe that there's some sort of preordained plan, some sort of arc towards the good, you have to ask yourself, why am I at this point in the arc? Right? What is my life's trials trying to teach me, or my life's goodness trying to teach me? And I think that someone who has a clear sense that, like, this was inevitable, people were going to go down to Egypt anyway, and God is going to redeem them, they're really going to ask themselves the question, why am I at this point in history instead of at that point? Right? And it seems pretty clear that Yaakov was not reconciled to having been sent to Egypt, because he makes sure before he dies that Joseph knows to bring his bones back to Israel. It doesn't seem like Yaakov's like, it had to happen to someone, it might as well have happened to me. It seems that he's not reconciled with the fact that it happened to him. That's a great question. Yeah.
You know, I think if you're a person of faith, then it's people, you can train yourself to kind of view the world in the kind of way where, you know, when you're in a valley, you know, you see this opportunity for a peak, and when you're at a peak, you can see yourself going in the other direction. You see it as all part of the divine plan. But I think in a practical sense, I think the societal problem that happens is the good, like when you're in a land of plenty and everything is great and everything is wonderful, I think the psychological thing that I see happening is the tendency for people to start to feel like, well, it's just me.
Mm-hmm.
I just did it. It's, you know, it's all me. I did it. Everything I've accomplished, all the wonderful things I have, everything I've built is me. People, you can still train yourself to be a person of faith and view that as more than that. But I think the typical thing is that, as opposed to the feeling of, I'm distracted by all this, you know, all this goodness, all this goshmious goodness is distracting me, and all I really need to do is focus on my service of God. So it's interesting. I mean, I see what they're saying, but it's just not the way I think most people in this day and age view the challenge. I think it's more that you just start to feel like, well, you know, you don't need God as much because everything's going so great.
Right, so I think that's definitely, I think that's a great insight, and I think that in some sense, you're arguing that the plain sense of the text, where you are so happy about your Bikurim and you can't forget God, is more relevant in today's day and age, and that's great. The one thing that I would say to respond to you is that there may not be a significant difference in his view between someone who's angry at God in a sort of active way and someone for whom God is absent just because you haven't been engaging with God. And he might even say that I would rather someone be actively yelling at God, why didn't you listen to my prayers, than not praying at all. So in that sense, I think he would say that actually, even if you don't conceive of yourself as being in this place where goodness is distracting you from God, you are. So that's my attempt to answer on his behalf, but I think that you're right. Yeah.
I find it fascinating and a little bit, it's holding me back a little, the fact that this discussion of Jacob's history begins with his interaction with Laban rather than his interaction with Esau, where he stole his birthright. And at an early age, you know, this was, you know, probably designed by God because he was the one who was supposed to carry through the covenant, but still, the first action is he tricks his brother and gets his birthright, which that was wealth.
Yeah, this is a narrative that does not assign blame to Yaakov for that, and also does not necessarily assign interest, material interest, to Yaakov in that. Most of the midrashic understanding of why Yaakov wanted to buy the birthright from Esav had nothing to do with money, but why would Esav want to serve in the temple? I want to serve in the temple. This spiritual, you know, service means nothing to him, but it means so much to me, so I'm going to buy it from him, give him the money that he wants, and I'm going to take the closeness to God that I want. Again, I don't think that that's necessarily the pshat of what a bechora means. A bechora means that you get twice the money. But I think that that's because he's inheriting that tradition of looking at Yaakov as being spiritually interested in that interaction, he wouldn't start it with Esau. We have time for one more comment. Yeah.
I mean, Yaakov wasn't necessarily
So Hashem was going to get him down there. It didn't matter how he was going to get down. Hashem complained that he, you know, wasn't grateful for his wealth, and he felt he was going to, you know, impede his spirituality. But that was the grand scheme of things, that he was going to go down. And also, the grand scheme of things is we were slaves in Egypt. But the severity of how we were going to serve in Egypt is up to us. So there's some things are preordained, but how they're going to pan out is up to how, you know, we behave.
Right, I mean, there's a what, but not necessarily a how.
Right.
Right. Well, thank you all. Happy Pesach.